You're listening to KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm Rick Dulock. In a few minutes, we'll hear from TV writer-turned-producer Phil Rosenthal about his work on the sitcom Coach and the huge part he played in the creation and success of Everybody Loves Raymond. He also shares how one behind-the-scenes interaction with Ray Romano eventually spawned a series starring Phil himself on PBS. KVCR-TV airs the series starting June 23rd. Also later in tonight's show, we'll preview the 2017 Redlands Bowl Summer Music Festival with Beverly Knorr. But we start this evening with Dovey Dee, an environmentally and culturally minded American artist living in Australia who has returned to the States with her beautiful Australian landscape paintings. They're on display at the Daw Center for the Arts in Pomona. Here's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez with Dovey Dee.
Your artwork is going to be on display at the DA Center for the Arts in Pomona. Your title is rather interesting. Will you describe your artwork in this exhibition?
Thank you for having me, first of all. I really appreciate it. The notion of a tectonic shift has to do with the movement of the earth and moving from one place to another. Since I had moved to Australia 16 years ago, I approached the Daw Center for the Arts about 18 months ago, having been affiliated with them prior to my moving to Australia. I said I wanted to bring a group of work from Australia back to Southern California as kind of a lesson about what wide open spaces are all about in Australia. Chris Tuvey and Margaret Ashel of the Daw Center for the Arts said, this sounds like a great idea as kind of a cultural exchange. The tectonic shift part has to do with intercontinental cultural exchange. Chris was able to curate several other artists with a like-minded sort of approach into this exhibit. It is about the meeting of several continents, really. So that's where the name comes from.
I get it now. Can you share a little bit about the other guests or artists that will be featured in this exhibit?
Chris Tuvey was able to curate, and Margaret Ashel were able to curate several other artists who had an interest in environmental approach to art. That is, they're curious about observing the external world rather than internal focus of the work. Mary Byerly, Rebecca Hamm, and Jyoti Duwadi. They're international in terms of they've lived in other countries, so they have more than just a local approach to their kind of work. Rebecca Hamm does these marvelous large-scale watercolors that are observations of habitat, of grasses, of rock formations. Mary Byerly does these wonderful clay sculptures that are very organic and very earth-like. Jyoti Duwadi has a multidisciplinary approach to temporal kinds of art installations or to other kinds of installations of art that are temporary or are illustrative of the environmental illustrations of earthworks.
I want to know how your professional life influenced your artwork life.
I actually am a trained artist. I have a Master of Fine Arts degree. Like most artists, one has to often have to take a checkered path to making a living. I happen to be very good at computer science applications, specifically geographic information systems. GIS, that's often used as a way of dealing with environmental management issues. So the whole idea of observation, science, repeatable methodologies, and mathematics actually influence the way that I'm now looking at my own art. And that is purely as an observer. In other words, I go out into the field, I do drawings in the field as if I am an observer of this natural habitat. Those field drawings then translate into big paintings in the studio where I can get a bit more expressionistic with it. They are landscape paintings. There's no internal vision for this necessarily, except from the emotion that I put into putting into the landscape paintings themselves. It is very much about looking at the open spaces of Australia.
Okay, so let me ask you, based on that, will you share the massive influence the country of Australia has had on your personal and your professional life?
Absolutely. The first thing you notice is the light. The light comes from the north, not from the south. The sun bites because it is so much more, the atmosphere is thinner. You can be sunburnt in 5 minutes. The soil is a color red that you cannot imagine. They have a whole different red spectrum for soils down there. It's iron ore of the oldest possible kind. The spaces are huge. There are no big, gigantic mountain ranges. The rivers are few and far between. The colors are muted gray greens that are reflected in these billabongs and water courses that reflected back in this impossibly blue sky. It's a vast continent, and you just don't see that here except in some places in the Southwest. The American landscape has changed vastly over the last, my short lifetime, 50 years. And Australia seems as though it is timeless, but everything has a time limit. So the paintings that I'm doing are about preservation of that site.
I'm speaking with Dovie Dee, who is the artist behind an exhibit here in Southern California in Pomona. It's the Tectonic Shift, a sense of place, a sense of space. I'm wondering how Australians felt about the artwork and how it represented their country. Did you get any feedback, any anecdotal comments?
Yes, actually, they're pretty excited about having the work over here and showing off Australia, because the countryside is... We tend to think of the Sydney Opera House or the Sydney Harbour or the landmarks that we're quite familiar with, like Uluru, Ayers Rock, rather than some of the more far-flung areas that are lesser known. And those are the kinds of things that I was capturing in my work. McDonnell Ranges, Ningaloo Reef, parts of Western Australia that aren't really accessible to the tourists. Not that they're totally inaccessible, but things that just don't get a lot of airplay, even in Australia. The natives were really quite happy to see that we were trying to promote that natural landscape to not just to Australians, but also to Americans. So hopefully it'll encourage Americans to come visit this incredible continent as well.
I don't think it needs a lot of encouragement for Americans to go to a beautiful country as Australia. When did you first develop a love for art? Was it at a very early age?
Yes, as a kid, it was always what I wanted to do, was to make art. The interceding years, you want to make a living, obviously. So discovering this penchant that I have for problem solving and for mathematics developed into the computer science area. That not only gave me the opportunity to make a living for myself, but I'm also an enthusiastic purchaser, collector of Australian art, not just young artists, but also established artists, particularly Aboriginal art. Their vision of art making is entirely different from our usual Eurocentric vision of time and space. It is a real honor and privilege to be able to learn from that kind of art making, where it's also part of an entire culture that gets preserved rather than an aesthetic, a pure aesthetic. It is also an entire culture that is actually being described. I've learned a great deal from their art making. So studying art from a very early age, getting that European kind of art history education, having to work in science in order to make a living, and then realizing that I could be a collector as well as an artist, has sort of developed this whole notion of what it means to have a landscape painting. That's where this is going.
The exhibit might interest a variety of individuals, maybe environmentalists, conservationists, nature lovers, as well as art enthusiasts, would you say?
Gosh, I hope so. I would like to be able to talk to individuals, particularly about environmental concerns, not just in Australia, but also here, and how the Aboriginal notion of custodians of the land is very important. Every public event in Australia is opened with an acknowledgement of country, and that is recognizing the traditional custodians of the land itself. And in that way, it helps to do the reconciliation of who is living on the land now and who has owned the land or who was the custodian for the land. I want to be able to acknowledge that here as well. So there is that environmental aspect of that we're actually custodians of the land. but also that we need to observe how the land is changing under our custodianship. That's part of it. And a lot of it's just part art, part science, and part internal love for the land.
Where does your artwork go from here?
Well, I want to be able to do more landscape work, and I want to be able to do more traveling around Australia and to do more of that plain air capturing the landscape. I want to make it bigger. One is always limited to the size of your studio, so I've had to do diptychs and triptychs and larger pieces in sections. So I'd like to be able to do just big pieces and have that luxury to be able to do that.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Daw Center for the Arts?
Absolutely. The Daw Center is an incredible place. It's been around for decades, I think so for some like 40 years now. Started out originally as a workplace and exhibition space for several Claremont artists. Has developed over the years into a community center for local arts programs for students, a gallery showing area for artists who couldn't get traction in Los Angeles, and has just developed into an extraordinary family of artists who are willing to put themselves out there and be an exhibition space for artists who are trying to get a toehold into the exhibition area of Southern California.
Tectonic Shift, a sense of place, a sense of space, an exhibit of paintings by Davy D. To learn more of this exhibit or to visit it, the artwork will be at 252 Main Street in Pomona till about July 22nd, I believe.
July 22nd, that's correct.
Davy, thank you for your thoughts, thank you for your artwork, and thank you for coming to America.
Thank you so much, Lillian, for your time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
KVCR's Lillian Vasquez with landscape artist Davy D. The exhibition, Tectonic Shifts, A Sense of Place, A Sense of Space, is happening now through July 22nd at the Daw Center for the Arts on Main Street in Pomona. Information on the exhibit, Davy D, and the three guest artists with the project is online at dawcenter.org. That's dacenter.org. Still ahead, sitcom master Phil Rosenthal on his fun PBS series soon airing on KVCR-TV and the Redlands Bowl Summer Music Festival. I'm Rick Dulock, and this is KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR and kvcrnews.org. I'm Rick Dulock. We'll finish tonight's program in conversation with Beverly Knorr, Executive Director of Redlands Bowl Performing Arts, presenting the 94th season of the Redlands Bowl Summer Music Festival. But first, let's find out how sitcom writer Phil Rosenthal went from Coach to Everybody Loves Raymond to his latest series for public television, I'll Have What Phil's Having. Here's Lillian with Phil.
What makes a person funny? Is it natural? Is it learned? Is it lived experience? How does it work?
Wow. You know, it's always that question of nature or nurture, right?
Right.
So I think I was born into a funny home. I think my parents were funny. I think their values were making each other laugh when they weren't screaming. And I think you pick that up. And you also, if you're a little kid like me, a little skinny kid, this is, I'm sure, something you've heard before, but since you can't compete physically, you look for ways to not get beaten up every day. And I found that if you utilized your sense of humor, you might live longer.
So you've been funny from the get-go.
I don't know if you would have thought I was funny, but enough people did to let me live this long.
In my mind, and maybe not in your mind, but it seems like you broke into the business relatively quickly. You left New York in 89, and by 95, you had your own show. Does that seem relatively quickly to you?
It does, but you have to understand that I was 29 in 1989. So there were 10 years after college where I was struggling. Yes, I'm an overnight sensation after 10 years.
But you were working on one of my favorite shows in the early 90s was Coach. How'd you get into that?
I had been on some other shows, and I guess people liked my writing enough to get on a show that someone had actually heard of. And I was very happy to work on Coach. Very nice people. And I learned a lot. And then in my third year on Coach, I got this video cassette of a comedian who had been on David Letterman. And Letterman said after 1 5-minute appearance from this comedian who'd been working 12 years also to try to get somewhere in life, Letterman said there should be a show for that guy. And so they set about looking for a writer to create a show for this Ray Romano fellow. And I got lucky.
You know, in watching and researching for this interview, you loved the show, you appreciated the show, and you were ready to end it. You were okay the show ended.
It's very important to end well. I had learned a lot from watching TV. One of the things I learned was a lot of shows can overstay their welcome,
right?
Can stay too long. And once you do that, the quality of the entire series' legacy is diminished. And so it's very important to end well, like it's very important to end any story well in any medium. Ending a series is good to leave before people say, hey, you should leave.
So did Mary Tyler Moore leave on time? Did MASH leave on time?
Absolutely, yes. Yes. Mary Tyler Moore, I hold up as the gold standard of sitcoms, and I think they did it so perfectly. I thought it built perfectly. Every year was better than the previous year, and then at their peak, they said goodbye. The legacy of that show is the gold standard.
When you were getting ready to end Everybody Loves Raymond, did you know what you were going to do next?
No, I had no idea. I really didn't. I was just grateful for the experience. I knew it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, that I would never have that again. Not just the experience of working with these beautiful people and, you know, creating a family on-screen and off-screen. You know, when you work for 9 years with a group of people, yeah, I guess some people have a terrible time, but we had a beautiful time, an incredible time. Not only was that a once-in-a-lifetime experience, but I was writing about my actual family, and I knew that I could never have it that way, exactly like that, again.
What a great experience to kind of have your second family about your first family, in essence. Is a bad joke a sin?
No.
No.
Repeating it over and over is.
Is, okay.
Anybody can make a bad joke, but you should know enough not to keep doing it.
I want to ask, and I don't mean this in an insulting way.
Always a good line to start with.
Do you have trouble giving gifts or choosing gifts that are... You send your mom pears, you give a toaster. I'm just kind of wondering where you're coming from when you give gifts.
Do you think those are bad gifts?
No, I would love it. But when you think about it, he sent his mom fruit. And, you know, when I watched the little thing on YouTube, I thought, he sent his mom fruit? And then you gave your cast, which I would love that toaster that said Everybody Loves Raymond. But I don't know. It seems like you thought deeply about the gift giving. So tell the story about the toaster.
Well, sure. I guess I should preface that story with the Fruit of the Month Club story.
Okay.
Because that became the pilot, right? I actually got this phone call. I thought I was being nice. I thought I would send them a box of Harry and David, Fruit of the Month. And I got that call from my mother. You know, I got your gift arrived. Did you know it was a box of pears? I said, yeah. She said, you know, there's over a dozen pears here. I said, what? She goes, what am I supposed to do with all these pears? I said, I think you're supposed to eat them. Myself? I said, no, share them with Dad, Chiba, how many pears can your father eat? I don't know, Mom. Why, you don't like pears? No, I like them. It's just so much. Do me a favor. Please don't ever send me any more fruit again. And I said, oh, well, you know, another box is coming next month. And she said, what, more pears? And I said, no, a different box every month. She said, every month? Oh, my God, you got us in some kind of cult. Please. She got so upset. I can't talk anymore. There's too much fruit in the house. And so that, I thought, was a very good illustration to show how crazy Ray's parents are in the show. Okay, so I put that in the pilot. That turned into something that I didn't realize. I thought people would look at that and say, well, Phil has a cute story there about his specific craziness in his house. I thought people would laugh at that. What I didn't realize was in that specificity was a universality. In other words, we all have this thing. I didn't realize how many people would respond like, oh, my God, I can't give my parents a gift without it blowing up in my face. And so this has become, to this day, I still get people saying to me, I had the same experience, not just with any gift, but with Fruit of the Month.
Which is really a beautiful, lovely gift. How nice is that? But when you think about it, it's funny. It's just funny.
It's a burden. And then every time I've given them a gift, something's been wrong. So you reference this toaster. I gave a toaster to them because I gave the cast and crew one, just a little holiday gift. Since it's domestic sitcom, I gave a domestic item, a toaster. It said, "Everybody Loves Raymond," on the side of the toaster. Okay, so I send it to them, and I think, well, they'll like it. They like the show, I think, and they're supposedly, you know, they like me. So I send it to them, and I don't hear from them. So I call my father, and I say, "Did you get the present?" He said, "What present?" I said, "I sent you something. Did you get it?" "Oh, yes, yes," he says, "very nice." And there's this silence, and I think that's odd. And then it hits me. I know what it is. He didn't open the box, because on the box it just says Cuisinart toaster. I said, "Get the box, open it up, and you'll see." And he says, "I don't have it with me right now."
Uh-oh.
And I said, what do you mean? He says, "Your mother wanted a coffee maker." So what they did was they took my toaster to Macy's, lied to them, right, and traded my gift for a coffee maker. Our joke in the writer's room was that somebody probably bought that toaster, got it home, opened the box, saw what it said, put it back in the box, took it back to Macy's and said, "I'd like the Frasier toaster."
Very good. So they never saw their toaster again.
They actually, just like in the episode that I did from that story, they went back and got, you know, they had to look through boxes, but they got it.
Oh, so that was the whole story then.
That was that story. You know, I tell writers this. Keep a journal of things that happen to you, especially funny stories that happen in your life or strange stories, because it's easier to write things down than to write.
Right, exactly. You know, I'm going to just spin off of this. I have an autistic son, and a lot of times I'll write down what he's done because at the time it's not funny. But I know in 2 weeks or in heck a day, it's going to be really funny what he just did. And so I keep a journal of all the things so that when I do give speeches, I try and find humor in autism the same way. But
isn't that great?
I digress.
You know, when I was at work, when I called my father to ask, did he get the toaster? And he tells me that he traded it for a coffee maker. I started screaming at him, "You are the show. Do you realize you're the show?" He said, "You're welcome." And
yeah, exactly.
And my friends all came to my room because I was screaming. And I hang up the phone. I said, "It's so frustrating. They're so frustrating." And my friend Steve said, "You got to write this episode." I said, "This is not an episode." He said, "Of course it is." I said, "No, it's not, because it's not funny. It's not funny."
So
that they
funny.
Keep doing this.
It's so funny.
And then, of course, in an hour, I realize, yes, maybe it's funny, not to me, but to you.
Somebody else looking in, it can be funny.
Our pain, the comedy of someone else's pain.
Exactly. So you're a creator, you're a writer, you're also an author. You wrote your book, "You're Lucky, You're Funny, How Life Becomes a Sitcom."
It's exactly what we're talking about right now. It's exactly like taking the stuff that happens in your life that you think is negative and maybe you could make something positive out of it.
Well, I didn't know that book exists, so I have to rush out and get that book.
Oh,
I'm sure I can find
it
somewhere.
The audiobook, people tell me, is even better because there's certain sound things on there, live things, that obviously you can't put in a written book.
And I read that you recorded the entire thing, so it must be delivered with your personality, and so it must be even funnier when you're reading it.
I tell people, it's like having me in the car with you for 7 hours.
Well, let's turn now to the PBS show.
Yeah.
So how did this PBS show come out? Is it you love to eat, you love to explore,
yes,
you love television?
Yes. All those things, yes. I'll tell you the whole genesis. I don't know how much time you have, but
I got time.
I'll try to be brief. When we were wrapping up the first season of Everybody Loves Raymond, I asked Ray Romano, "What are you going to do on your vacation in between seasons?" And he says, "Oh, I'm going to go to the Jersey Shore." And I said, "Oh, that's nice. You ever been to Europe?" He goes, "Nah." I said, "No, why not?" He goes, "Oh, I'm not really interested in other cultures, even his own culture, Italy. His family's Italian." I said, a light bulb went off. I said, we gotta do an episode where we send him to Italy as Ray Romano, and then we send him back as Roberto Benigni after he's been transformed by the magic of traveling, and especially Italy. Okay, so it took 5 years to get the money from CBS to do that episode, but we did it. There was a two-part. It was like an hour. It was our little movie, and I loved it. It's one of my favorites. I wrote it myself because I knew the beauty and magic of Italy. I had something very important I wanted to express about how travel changes your life.
Right.
And don't you know, the best thing about the episode is that I saw that what happened to Ray, the character that I wrote in the thing, happened to Ray, the person. He was transformed.
Right.
He got it. And so now he goes. So the second light bulb goes off. What if I could do that for other people? And so I've had that idea since then. We're talking about 10, 15 years. I've had that in the back of my head. Someday, maybe I'll get to do a show like that. So in between then and now, I got this offer to go to Russia to help the Russians turn Everybody Loves Raymond into a Russian sitcom, Everybody Loves Kostya.
Oh.
And I filmed the whole process, and that's a documentary called Exporting Raymond. It's on Netflix, came out a few years ago. So PBS sees this documentary, and they call me in, and they say, we like this movie, we like you, we like the idea of you going places. I said, so does my wife. What do you have in mind? And they said, what do you have in mind? And I said, okay, here's the idea. How about a show where every episode I go to a different great place on earth and I show you where to eat as a way to get you to come and travel? And they said, you're going to think I'm making this up. We've been looking for a food and travel show with humor for years. They said, where would you like to go first?
Wow.
So they gave me six on the air right away. That's our first season.
So you have Tokyo, Italy, Paris, Hong Kong, and where else? Barcelona. And then one of my favorites, which we'll talk about in a second, is Los Angeles, even though it's just right up the street, because you're going to be hanging out with some of your cool comedic friends.
Well, not just that, but, you know, L.A., I'm going to say this, the best food city in America at the moment because of our cultural diversity.
More so than New York?
Even more at the moment. This is ever shifting.
Wow.
But, I mean, this is just a fact. Almost every nationality that you can think of is here. And so when you have this diversity and you have these numbers, these sheer numbers, don't you know you're going to also have some great restaurants and great cultural things come out of that gigantic community? The sheer size of LA and its environs is way bigger. So we have it. It's like if you take a lot of pictures, you know, there's going to be some greats in there.
Right.
The other reason that I chose Los Angeles as the one American city in the first six is because I want to show you that you can travel in your own town. I know we all can't afford to travel overseas and go even across the country, but there's a wonderful restaurant or culture or cuisine that you haven't tried yet in the place you live.
In your own backyard.
In your own backyard. And because we're so safety-oriented, meaning I know what I know, I like what I like, I'm going to keep doing that, I'm saying take one step to the right or to the left and try something else. Your mind will be expanded and your life will be better.
So we're creatures of habit, much like Raymond.
Yep.
And you're trying to get us out of that environment.
It all stems from him saying, I'm not really interested in other cultures.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, mostly because you bring the humor. I want to ask about the title. Was that title your idea, I Have What Phil's Having?
It wasn't my idea. This is great. I'm so glad you asked me. This is an unbelievable story. My friend Vanessa Silverton, who is Nancy Silverton's daughter, she's a great chef, but Vanessa was a producer on the Rachel Maddow Show, and now she's a great agent. She's just brilliant. And when I was thinking of titles for the show, I sent a few. Like my friend told me, whenever we go to eat, we look at the menu and we think, what would Phil order? So I was thinking of that as a title, and that's one of them I sent. And she wrote me back, how about I'll Have What Phil's Having? And I was sitting at a deli in New York with my brother, and I showed it to him, and he said, yeah, that seems like it. At that moment, the waiter came over with the check at the deli, and he says, you're sitting at the lucky table. I said, what do you mean? And he points to a sign over our heads that we hadn't noticed yet. And the sign says, at this table at Katz's Deli was the famous scene Harry Met Sally, where she said, I'll have what she's having.
I knew it had to have some kind of tie-in.
Of course it did.
Oh, how beautiful.
So
that's a great story.
This is meant to be. Because not only does it connote, I'll have what Phil's having, connote he's eating something, but it relates to something that we know was funny.
Yes, it was.
So there we go. How could I not call it that?
Great name. And I know the first time I heard it, I thought of that very scene, of that very thought of the woman. Whose mother is it?
It's actually Rob Reiner's mother, Carl Reiner's wife, Estelle. And Billy Crystal came up with the line on the set while they were filming and gave it to her.
It was great.
Pretty great.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So I know you went to these six locations and you shot these. I'm sure they were all wonderful. But is there one that you enjoyed?
Italy.
For it? Okay. Why?
Italy wins. That's just the fact. For me, you know, all this stuff is subjective.
Mm-hmm.
People have their favorites, and I hope they do. But for me, Italy is the whole package. And I recommend it. If you never traveled anywhere before, I don't think you can go wrong. First of all, it's so spectacular and beautiful everywhere you look. What more do you want in a vacation of any kind? Then you have the cultural history that you can't help soaking in as you walk down the streets, even if you never went into a church or museum. And then when you do, you're the top of your head blows off. And then the food is incredible. And then the people who are making the food and the people on the street, they're hugging and kissing you. What's not to like?
Right.
So that's why.
Okay, last question. You left acting and writing and producing. Well, you left acting because you started off as an actor, right?
I did, because when you're a kid and you're watching all that television, you don't really know that there's writing and directing and producing. You just see the actors and
right.
You go, I want to do that. I want to be that. And so that's what I pursued. And the only way to pursue that is you get in the school plays, right?
Right.
And then you're in college. You want to do that. And then when you graduate college, or when I graduated college, I struggled. And so the transition for me was a group of friends of mine and I wrote something for ourselves to be in because no one else was casting us. There's a lot of competition out there. So that was a transition to writing. And then just at that time, just a bit of serendipity, a friend who was a writer who thought I was funny wanted to collaborate with me on a screenplay. And we sold that screenplay. First thing I ever wrote. And it didn't even get made. But I made, you know, way more money as a writer all of a sudden than I did as an actor. And I realized I could go from eating tuna fish for dinner every night to eating whatever I wanted. So that was the impetus to stay with writing. And that led to directing and then producing. And now I love every aspect of the business. I really do. I love show business. The only part of the business I don't like is the business.
Is the business part of the business.
You got it.
Right. I'll have what Phil's having. Looking forward to it. And looking forward to watching your humor just within those that you interact with while you're at the table.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for your time.
I'll have what Phil's having. The 6-episode series airs this summer, Friday nights at 7 and Wednesday evenings at 5, starting June 23rd. There's more online at the KVCR TV website, at kvcr.org. You're listening to 91.9 KVCR and kvcrnews.org. This is KVC Arts. I'm Rick Dulock. If you've spent even a year or two near the east end of the San Bernardino Valley, you've probably heard of the Redlands Bowl. The proper name is the Redlands Bowl Summer Music Festival, and it never disappoints. All summer long, it is music, theater, and community without admission, although they do ask for goodwill donations during intermission. Residents from Redlands and surrounding communities start looking forward to the performances as soon as the days get longer. Beverly Knorr, Executive Director of Redlands Bowl Performing Arts, shares this 2017 preview with our own Lillian Vasquez.
So what is the Bowl's mission for its community, for the community of Redlands and the Inland Empire?
Well, at the heart of it, our mission is music for everyone. Gray Stuart Mullen, our founder, who founded the Redlands Bowl in 1923, was friends with Artie Mason Carter, who was the founder of the Hollywood Bowl, and she wanted something like that for Redlands, but she wanted it to be free of admission charge so that everyone could attend. And at that time, sort of concert attendance was very stratified because really only the very wealthy could afford concert tickets to the, you know, the lovely concert halls back in the day. And she wanted everybody to experience performing arts and world-class performing arts. So she founded the Redlands Bowl Summer Music Festival. And, you know, no one expected it to be able to thrive. And it has. And this will be our 94th season.
Well, let's talk about your 94th season. That's quite an accomplishment. But there's a few changes this season.
Yes, actually, we've gone through a name change. It was before it was Redlands Community Music Association, which we had from the founding. Redlands Bowl Performing Arts came about as part of a strategic process that our organization went through. And the idea was, you know, as we look towards our 100th year anniversary in just a few short years, the idea is that we wanted to see who are we now, where are we going, and we wanted to be consistent with who we are and our vision ahead. And so the board made a very significant decision. In keeping with other world-class performing arts centers around the country, we determined that we would henceforth be Redlands Bowl Performing Arts.
And it's a great name. I think most people that live in this community just call it the Redlands Bowl.
Exactly.
And so that kind of goes well with it. So let's talk about what's on tap for the season. I know the season begins June 30th.
Yes.
And it kicks off with 76 trombones and more.
Yes. And that is a wonderful program. We're so excited to be collaborating with the University of Redlands, who have their international trombone conference on the campus. They are bringing many of these outstanding trombonists, award-winning trombonists, to our performance, and they will be our special soloists for that night. So there are going to be tons of trombones, and it's going to be a big celebration of bulldogs. So it's going to be great fun.
So 76 trombone, obviously from the song, does that mean there will be 76 trombones there? It seems pretty large.
Maybe.
Okay. Ooh, look at you. All right, well, let's talk about the next one, the Air National Guard Band. I know that I hear in the community that one is really a popular night.
Yeah, it really is. It's interesting. If you look around at performing arts venues and fairs and that kind of thing, you don't often hear truly patriotic music that much anymore. So we always make that as part of our season template to have a patriotic band of some sort. And this year, we're very fortunate to have Air National Guard Band of the West Coast.
And I think it's also something that multi-generations can enjoy, from the kid to the grandchild to maybe the great-grandparent.
Yes, and I think they want to pass these important songs and the history of our country onto their children. So it really is a multi-generational audience for that evening.
Now, we should say that the performances are on Tuesdays and Fridays. On July 11th, you have the Young Artists.
Yes. Let me tell you, I'm so excited to share about this competition. It has changed so much. As part of our strategic changes in our organization, we decided to overview this event and turn it into a complete concerto performance. And so that means that all of the finalists that have won will be performing with orchestra that night. It used to be a recital format. Now it's with orchestra. And so the pieces of music that they choose are conducive to working with an orchestra. So it makes the performance a lot fuller and funner for the audience. And we just know everybody's going to enjoy it. The other thing is the finalist, the grand winner will not be announced until the end of the evening. So there's a lovely, exciting
build-up. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I have to say, Redlands, I call her Redlands' own Angel Blue, but she went to the University of Redlands, and she has she is a former Young Artist winner herself. She will be headlining that evening. And Angel is probably, for me, one of the best voices I've ever heard. She just has a beautiful, unique voice, and she has performed in all the wonderful venues now around the world.
Nice.
And so we're very excited about having her
back. She's all grown up.
Yeah, she's grown up. She's taking the world by storm in her career, and she loves Redlands, and she loves that she's coming back to be a part of this.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. Let's talk about the Modern Gentlemen. They sound kind of cool to me.
Well, they are very cool, and they're very cute.
I wasn't going to say that, but they really
but they are
quite nice.
They're just darling. We a team of us saw them perform before, and they're not only extremely good vocalists, but they are so funny on stage. So it's a whole evening of laugh. And
what's the music?
They're actually the backup group for Frankie Valli. So when they're not touring with him, they have their own, the Modern Gentlemen, perform by themselves, and they do kind of the music of Frankie Valli, but also
nice.
All those other wonderful 50s, 60s groups. So it's very lively, loads of fun. People
I need to reserve a seat for that night.
Yes.
I know I got to get there early.
Yes.
And then on July 18th, it's Villalobos Brothers.
Let me just say, these guys are amazing, and they are probably the group I'm just most looking forward to seeing. You know, they bring in traditional Mexican music, but it's also a fusion. It's got so many influences, and it's exciting from beginning to end. The crowd will absolutely love them. They're award-winning. They played Carnegie Hall, Kennedy Center. They are absolutely outstanding.
That's great. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Bluegrass Band on July 21st.
You know, who would have thought? But this program works with bluegrass. It's absolutely beautiful. The repertoire of the Beatles that we all love and cherish, and They do it to bluegrass, and it just makes it fun and different, but you know the words and can kind of sing along, and it's great fun.
I'm speaking with Beverly Knorr. She's the executive director of the Redlands Bowl Performing Arts, and we're kind of going through the summer season, the 94th season that's beginning quite soon, just around the corner. Let's talk about the musical that's coming this year, because you guys always do like a 3 or 4 day musical, and this year it's Tarzan.
It's Tarzan. We're so excited because we have never done Tarzan before, and I cannot tell you the excitement in the community about this musical. People are really excited. You know, it's the wonderful soundtrack, Phil Collins soundtrack.
It is Phil Collins music.
Yeah.
Nice.
And so it's got that very modern flavor of sort of a rock opera feeling to it. And, of course, people will be swinging through the bowl stage. So we're all excited to see how they pull
Pun
that off.
Pun totally intended, huh?
Yeah, we have our wonderful Paul Jacques, who's been with us for many musicals. And he has really top talent this year. So it's going to be so much fun for the whole family.
All right, so beginning in August, on August 1st, you have the Redlands Symphony.
The Redlands Symphony, featuring their own conductor, Ransom Wilson. He's just a wonderful storyteller about any piece of music he's doing. He gives history and sort of a tutorial as he goes. It's really fun. And he's doing the very luscious Brandenburg Concertos.
Mystic India on August 4th.
We showed this video, a video of Mystic India, to a little pre-audience that we did an event for with the bowl, and they were absolutely blown away by them. It's epic. It's really epic. The costumes are beautiful. It's the music and the feeling and the flavor of India, but with a modern twist with the whole Bollywood craziness and excitement that people have for this genre of filmmaking. And so, you know, all I can say is come and hold on to your seat because it's going to be really big and wonderful.
Okay, so tell me about Riders in the Sky.
Two-time Grammy Award winners. You know, you love Cowboy.
Yeah, who doesn't?
We all love Cowboys. And they're funny. And, you know, they're one of the things that they're most known for is Woody's Roundup from the Toy Story movies.
Right.
And, but they're just, they are the traditional funny prairie storytelling and jokester banter on stage. They're just loads of fun. And this is part of a partnership we have with Loma Linda University Health. And so we're very excited to be presenting this program. And
that's on August 8th. And then on August 11th, you have Opera Under the Stars.
Well, Frank Fetta, our wonderful conductor of over 30 years now, he brings us the most wonderful, yummy talent, opera singers, and this year's no exception. You know, it's just going to be an evening of wonderful arias under the stars, and people love it. People come from all over to see our opera talent, so we're very excited about his lineup for this year.
Terrific. Wartime Radio Review on August 15th.
Yes, this is a little different for us. We always have a big band program. It's one of our most popular programs at the Bowl, but this is a complete review, so you have the wonderful scenery of that era. It looks like a, you know, typical big band of that time, and they have the bullet mics and the, you know, the Andrews sisters.
Naturally.
It's just such a fun program, and we've actually seen this perform before, and I think our bowl audience is going to love it.
State Street Ballet, who will be presenting Cinderella.
Yes, we've had State Street Ballet, and of course KVCR has filmed them several times for us, and they're just absolutely magnificent. When you watch them, there's just a seamlessness to their dance. It flows together so beautifully. They're just magnificent. Had a little bit of an absence from the bowl for a few years. We're so excited to have them back. And I think every little girl in the region is going to wear their tutu and just
How cute.
Dream of being a princess. It's going to be a lovely night.
And then on August 22nd, I might indicate that's when my first grandbaby is due. Celtic Spring will be there performing for my grandbaby's arrival.
Oh, that's fantastic. Celtic Spring actually appeared at the Bowl many years ago. They've now grown up a little bit more, but they're an award-winning Celtic group, and it's all one family. So you get these really, this wonderful rapport between siblings, and it's just really lovely to watch.
Now I want to talk about your season finale. It's a tribute to one of my favorites. I had always hoped to interview her. I tried so many times and never got the interview, but it's a tribute to Debbie Reynolds and her daughter, Carrie Fisher.
Yeah. We talked about this early on with Frank and Valerie Pister, our wonderful program director. you know, it was just so fresh in the hearts of everyone at the time. And great music from, of course, Star Wars, and great music. I don't know about you, but I grew up watching the Tammy movies with my mother, and we'd watch them on the, you know, the Saturday afternoon matinee things that would come on Channel 5, I remember. And
absolutely, you know, yep, KTLA, you know, watching
yes,
it, absolutely.
Exactly. Yep. And my mom introduced me to all those old Tammy movies. And Debbie Reynolds was one of America's sweethearts. And so I think it's very timely that we're going to be doing this music.
Is the music, will it have like Singing in the Rain? Will it have anything from one of my all-time favorite movies, The Unsinkable Molly Brown? Will it have anything from there? If not,
yes,
we need to put that request in,
yeah,
right now, Bev.
We'll let Frank know. I believe that is. I know Singing in the Rain is for sure, and I believe Molly is as well. Whatever it'll be, you know, we try to be as respectful and as honorable to those wonderful icons in our America songbook. And
the other thing I want to ask you about, some of the wonderful opportunities for children ages, I guess, 4 to 12, mm-hmm. with the Children's Summer Music Workshop.
Yeah.
How does that work and who gets involved?
Okay, so our Children's Festival workshops have, they are on Tuesdays and Saturdays. Tuesdays they're at Mission Gables, and then we have workshop on Saturday at Redlands Community Center. And these workshops have been going on for decades, and they began as sort of music appreciation programs, but have evolved into very interactive hands-on programs. And so kids get to see these award-winning artists up close and personal and interact with them. It's a very unique program. We don't know of it too much in the United States.
So is it in conjunction, like you'll have a performance on Tuesday that evening and the kids get to work with the artists that day? Is that how
yeah,
it works?
Yeah, it doesn't work out for every single
sure.
artist. So a lot of our artists are the ones performing on stage, and it gives the kids a really unique experience to interact with them, ask them questions, and it's just very hands-on and
do personal. You know if any of the students might later come to that performance so they can see what they just met and watch that artist perform?
Exactly. That's our hope. You know, we always are concerned with the life cycle of loving the performing arts. So we always think of our little ones going up to, you know, 90s, 100, people enjoying the performing. That's our goal, always.
I've been talking with Beverly Knorr, the executive director of the Redlands Bowl Performing Arts under its new name, about to celebrate their 94th season. I can hardly wait for the 100th season and learning more about it. Bev, thanks so much for the Redlands Bowl and all they do for our community.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Lillian.
That's Redlands Bowl Performing Arts Executive Director Beverly Knorr with our own Lillian Vasquez. The 94th season of the Redlands Bowl Summer Music Festival kicks off on June 30th with the San Bernardino Symphony's 76 trombones and more. The complete schedule and much more information is available online at redlandsbowl.org. Well, that wraps up this week's episode of KVC Arts. We thank Beverly Knorr from Redlands Bowl Performing Arts for spending time with us today. Thanks also to Dovey D, the featured artist of the exhibition Tectonic Shift, A Sense of Place, A Sense of Space, now at the Daw Center for the Arts on Main Street in Pomona. Online at dawcenter.org. That's dacenter.org. And thanks to Phil Rosenthal from the PBS series I'll Have What Phil's Having, airing on KVCR-TV Friday and Wednesday evenings starting June 23rd. More online at kvcr.org. Thanks to Sean Longstreet for creating and performing our theme music. And thanks very much to KVCR's Lillian Vasquez for nearly every KVC Arts interview over the past several weeks. Our regular host, David Fleming, is in the house. He's back behind the mic for next week's show. So many thanks for all of your good thoughts radiated toward David this past couple of months. Finally, thanks to you for listening. Your support of 91.9 KVCR is welcome right now or anytime at kvcrnews.org. Keep it right here on NPR for the Inland Empire, KVCR, where you learn something new every day. I'm Rick Dulock. Have a great night.
Can't look at hobbles and I can't stand fences. Don't fence me in. No, no. Don't fence me in.